parfait.
Match day 9, Ireland in action tomorrow, a nation very much in waiting for this big clash coming up against Egypt, but we've got to focus on, well, the other game in Group F today, England versus Netherlands, but before that, Group C, Brazil versus Costa Rica and Scotland versus Sweden. Dave, you're going to take us through Brazil-Costa Rica, and there's been some criticism. I mean, we mentioned this in the intro about how the 82 team is a beloved and no team, probably even to this day, can hold a match to them. Well, at this point, after Brazil's sort of kind of shoddy show, I mean, it wasn't shoddy, it was a 2-0 victory, and in this World Cup, that's probably an amazing performance. But again, it's the Samba, it's the Yoga Bonita ideals that seem to have died at this point. And Pelé's been out in force criticising Brazil, their style of play, saying essentially that you can win, but you can still win pretty, and they're not doing that at the moment. The Brazil manager responds with a glorious quote: "The only opinion that prevails in the end is mine." A little bit of Jack Charlton's making there in that kind of thing. Headstrong, but it's just maybe it's the English translation that makes that sense. But I love that. "The only opinion that prevails is mine."
Yeah, two teams coming into the game, both with a win under their belts, both knowing that a win will guarantee them a place in the knockout round. So a big game. Brazil, I think everybody would have expected them to be at this point. Costa Rica, maybe not so much, having perhaps surprisingly in their first World Cup beating Scotland in the first round. Costa Rica probably still a bit of an unknown quantity in world football at that time. Brazil maybe not, but going through, as we spoke in previous shows about the Samba style Brazil team of old to the more pragmatic Brazil that we've probably known for the last, you know, 30 plus years now. I guess the presence of Dunga in the midfield in this World Cup is probably emblematic of sort of the change in mindset that's gone on in Brazil football over the years. But, you know, even just looking down through the squad, the talent that they had, the likes of Taffarel and goal, Jorginho, Dunga, who's a great player as well, Branco, famous Middlesbrough player, Careca up front, who I spoke about before, I'm a huge admirer of him, and Muller up front, who maybe surprisingly to students of later football was keeping Romario and Bebeto out of the starting lineup. And it was his goal in the end that you know, a scrappy enough goal that settled the tie late in the first half. A fairly long sequence of play where the Brazilians are putting a lot of pressure on, but maybe not doing it in a typically Brazilian way. There's a lot of crosses, a lot of bobbling, a lot of the ball kind of bouncing around, and that's how the ball fell for Muller to put a scrappy sort of volley into the net, and that proved to be enough on the day for Brazil. Costa Rica, you know, even though they lost the game, still left themselves in a fairly good position to qualify, with Sweden to come in their final game. And Brazil would march on to face Scotland, knowing that they had the cushion of knockout football in their pockets.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit about Muller for a second, Tarlok. There seems to have been a lot of love for Muller. And people, I mean, if you're thinking back to him as a player, you probably wouldn't go thinking too much beyond, oh, he's pretty good. Like, I mean, even Dave's mentioning Careca there more so than Muller. But a lot of love for Muller at this point.
Yeah, he's been assessed in some portions of the media, admittedly the Brazilian media, as the best striker in the world. I don't think he was even the best striker in the Brazilian team. But yeah, we've discussed that. We've had a few
maybe
very
the best
big
striker on the bench.
Possibly not. We've had a few very big claims in this World Cup so far. We've had Chris Hughton's notorious Townsend Brady comparison. We've had Ali McCoist telling us that Mo Johnson is top three striker in the world. But I think the Muller one's up there. He's definitely not the best player named effectively by Gerd Muller's parents.
That's fairly true. Muller's gone on to be, I know, a bit of a commentator in Brazil. I think his last appearance for Brazil would have been around 90, or towards the end of the 90s, 98, 99. He's popped up a couple of times since. I mean, minimal appearances from clubs from the 2000s. And then into 2015, apparently, as well. But that's all I can track down. Pretty interesting one, all right. Let's talk about Scotland then. I mean, they desperately need a win here following what some have called in the press as their worst World Cup result in their history. It's a little bit over the top. They don't.
It's over the top because they've had a few of them.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. They don't have a plethora of wins to choose from here. Like, I think they've four wins up to this point in World Cups, or three wins or something like that. But then essentially they desperately need a result here. And the managers had to make a bit of a change. Gordon Drury and Robert Fleck have come in, and really they prove absolutely vital in this game, running on to various long searching passes down the flank. There's a little bit post-match of sort of Jack Charlton would be proud of this performance in the Irish press, certainly. But I have to say, some of the passing in this is fantastic with these players, particularly Fleck getting on to the end of a lot of them. They're not just hoofed up in the air. There's some long, you know, diags that really do end up affecting the game for Scotland. And having been a bit ponderous against Costa Rica, going more direct has worked out beautifully for them here.
It's good of the John Caulfield's about it, isn't it, in terms of having the two big men out on the wings. Yeah. Gordon Drury, I don't think anyone would ever mistake him for a winger.
Stuart McCall's first international goal, 10 minutes in from a corner, puts Scotland in the lead. Cross comes in, David McPherson heads on, and Stuart McCall's pretty brave, dives in with his toe to get a toe poke. I mean, you know, there's a little bit of a risk to him of sort of as the defender comes in, but Stuart's used to a bump and a fall, if you remember him falling off the car in that famous YouTube clip with can in his hand. Doesn't spill a drop of the can. Anytime you talk about Stuart McCall, you have to bring that up. The Tartan Army going into absolute raptures in Genoa then with this goal. Exactly the start they needed, 10 minutes in. Very, very impressive stuff from them early on. Sweden come back into it a little bit at this point. There's a little bit of danger here and there from Thomas Brolin, but overall, Jim Leighton's done well to keep him out. And Craig Levein, who's been brought in because of a few injuries, actually does a pretty good job in keeping him quiet. And as the game goes on, I mean, Sweden coming forward a little bit, but in the 81st minute, it's the captain, Roy Aitken. He gets on the end of it. A great through ball by Fleck out wide. And Fleck just made such a difference in this game. He gets on to, again, then another great ball down the right. He sort of really, really times it very well. It's like on Aitken's foot as he approaches. And he manages to drive a show. Ravelli saves his shot. And as Aitken goes for the follow-up, even though he's going away from goal, the Swedish defender clumsily clips him. And it's one of the top three strikers in the world, Mo Johnson, who slots the penalty home. And all is looking pretty rosy for Scotland. That is, until they bring on Ali McCoist in the 84th minute for Fleck. Now, Fleck has been so energetic. I mean, up until this point, as I said, that's the 81st minute. He's essentially created that second goal. But I'm not blaming Ali McCoist there, but I mean, it didn't take long for his introduction and the goal to come right after. But about 5 minutes after Glenn Stromberg is brought in, the substitute, he gets on the end of a lofted ball to make it 2-1. Scottish defence falling asleep. And actually, the Swedish manager, Ollie Norden, got a lot of criticism for not bringing Stromberg in earlier because he'd come in against Brazil as well and made quite a big impact there. Scotland now essentially just need a draw against, just a point against Brazil, and they'll manage to find themselves through. So I believe Sweden can still qualify, but they need Brazil to beat Scotland, and they need a result against Costa Rica as well for that to work out for them.
Hey, it just came, it just happened.
It's rumoured you were once caught short during a game.
I've never admitted to it, but it is true.
It is true?
Yeah. How much detail do you want here, mate?
No, I don't want any detail.
It just came, it just happened. And it was a World Cup game.
You're joking?
No.
How come you didn't get filmed?
It's filmed. I've seen it. It just came, it just happened. I was very fortunate it rained that night, so I could do something about it. It was messy. It just came, it just happened.
You were not feeling very well.
I was not very well. I was poorly at half time. I carried on. There was a ball went down the left hand side. I actually did try to tackle someone, stretch, relax myself. And it just came, it just happened.
Up next, we go to, an important game for us, England versus Netherlands. We're going to have a keen eye on this one. Turlock, I think you're going to take us through this game.
Obviously, this was, as you say, as keenly watched in Ireland as almost anywhere else. I think the consensus probably was that we wanted a draw from this game, just to keep our rivals as pegged back as far as possible. Again, with the assumption that Ireland are going to do a number on Egypt in a couple of days. England had been fairly roundly roasted for their performance in the first game against Ireland, and they'd responded to that by taking out Peter Beardsley and Gary Stevens and completely shifting the system around. We found out in subsequent years that this was as a result of pressure from the squad itself. that they wanted to shift to a sweeper system from a flat back four. So Mark Wright comes in as the sweeper. Terry Butcher stays in because apparently he's indispensable to Robson. He just can't countenance the team without him. So that was Robson's compromise. I'll go to a sweeper system if we can keep Butcher in the side. Extraordinary that you have those kinds of negotiations going on before a big game, but I suppose England have been very heavily chastened by being beaten 3-1 by the Netherlands at Euro 88 when they lost all three of their games. Van Basten got a hat-trick in that game. Van Basten, again, was the capocannoniere, the top scorer in Serie A in the season just concluded. He was champion of Europe. He was, however, deployed nominally up front on his own by Leo Beenhakker, the new Dutch coach took over from Michaels for this game. In fact, he played kind of similar to what we call a false nine now. He plays very deep and he doesn't really trouble the English defence. And it's only Hullet really in the first half who's running beyond him. But yeah, that's getting a bit of ahead of ourselves. There has been some dissension in the English camp, or more to the point, the English camp have been particularly livid with the English media. They feel they've been misrepresented. Gazza gives a very kind of uncharacteristically somber and testy interview to Des Lynam, which, you know, he's at pains to point out that he does take the World Cup seriously and that, you know, he takes playing for England very seriously. But that doesn't cut much ice.
He probably had a point in terms of, you know, who does Des Lynam really support, considering he's from Ireland?
Yeah, Des was fairly quiet about his County Clare connections in these years. But not everyone was buying into the kind of burgeoning Gazza mania. Rodney Marsh said before the game that comparing Gascoigne to Pelé was like comparing Rembrandt to Rolf Harris, which somehow has only got less flattering in the years since. But yeah, this was a classic.
Marsh has said worse in the intervening years as well.
Wasn't he cancelled for making a joke about the tsunami before being cancelled was a thing?
Yeah.
In 2004.
Can I ask, just when you're saying about the English press at this time, because we know historically they had the turnip for Grant Taylor and all that stuff. Was there absolutely no funny headline or image used about Gary Lineker shitting himself in the pitch in the Ireland game? Because
I think there was a D notice put on that.
Right.
The kind of MOD, do not report on this by under any circumstances. It is actually referenced afterwards. Lineker references that he had a stomach problem during the game and didn't feel well, but not in explicit detail. That's only something that only came to light in later years when he was...
Well, I think he expressed it in explicit detail during the match. I don't think he needed to...
He also has made it clear since that it was nothing to do with Walker's crisps, that they did not make him ill. So, you know, nothing to do with that.
Yeah, I think the lack of HD in this period was possibly a blessing when it came to that particular incident. But yeah, the game itself, kind of classic game of two halves. Poor enough first half. The Dutch have the most possession, but can't really work anything. I think England kind of just settling into their system, taking a look at the Dutch. As I said, Van Basten plays very withdrawn. Hullet gets beyond them a few times, but they don't really create a huge amount. England's, I don't know what was their best chance, but certainly their funniest chance early in the second half was when Lineker crossed for Stuart Pearce, who was up in a Roberto Carlos type position, more or less a mirror image of Van Basten's goal against the USSR. Stuart Pearce tried the same shot. It went about as well as you'd expect. Shortly after that, Johnny Van Schip has had a shot straight at Peter Shilton. Shilton looked very nervous in this game. He's punching an awful lot, which, again, not a classically English thing. Again, he owed his continued presence in the team to Robson's championing of him. Robson says that Shilton's been on a special diet, a special training regime. He's cut out alcohol, which has made all the difference. If he'd been reading his tweets, he could maybe do that again. Yeah, but he looks shaky. He looks seriously shaky, and he fumbles a couple of times.
Is it because he cut out the alcohol?
Isn't there an unbelievable quote from Robson on Peter Shilton where it's one of those? It's like, Bob, why did you even start talking here? Where he says Peter Shilton is Peter Shilton, and he'll always be Peter Shilton, and he's been Peter Shilton since the year dot. It was like, I've no idea what that means.
Well, I think notable in the sense that we were just discussing earlier that the year dot was 1949. Peter Shilton, the only player in this tournament, was born in the 1940s, which is a frightening thought if he was
possibly Roger
my Mead. Age then.
Possibly Roger Mead. We're not sure.
Arguably, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he's also wearing shoulder pads, which is a very kind of anachronistic look. But I mean, again, maybe his joints are falling apart. But yeah, England's best chance, and certainly the first period of the second half, is when Lineker, who's playing very wide on the right, which was, I think, a habit that Cruyff got him into at Barcelona. He played him wide on the right a lot. He runs Van Tiggelen and fires across the six-yard box, but no one can connect with it. And then Gazza really takes command. This is kind of the first indication of just what a good player Gazza is at international level. And he's really dribbling past Dutch midfielders for fun. He's picking it up very deep, which kind of limits the amount of impact that he can have. But he does force a free kick pretty much right on the D that Stuart Pearce just drives straight at Van Breukelen. And then another one of the new boys, Paul Parker, who's come in at right back. He crosses low for Lineker. Lineker, at the near post, makes a good contact. Van Breukelen saves it. Lineker picks up the rebound and absolutely buries it, but is whistled back for, on replay, a very apparent handball. Again, not something we needed VAR to pick up. John Barnes, who, again, another player who, I guess somewhat like Chris Waddle, England's two wide players, was often accused of not really delivering on international level at international level, but he plays in Lineker. Lineker slices a good chance wide on his left foot from about 10 yards out. And England are really on top at this stage. The Dutch really have nothing about them at all, which, considering they were kind of on the fringes of the favourites group for the World Cup, obviously as European champions, it's surprising how poor they are in this game. I suppose not that surprising after their earlier result against Egypt.
Do you think, is it purely that shift to sweeper that's done them here, and is this something Ireland should be taking lessons from at this point? Because, as you said, they really haven't shown up. I mean, I don't really know what you can say, what's wrong with them. Like, they just haven't produced anything.
It seems to be a coaching issue. Blaine Hacker is kind of not particularly rated in the Netherlands, and seems to be a very conservative coach. As I say, they're playing almost without a striker, and Hullet is kind of playing the English on his own. It seems to be just playing off his own initiative. I can't imagine he was told to play that way, or he was told to, you know, basically function as a forward because no one else is getting up with Van Basten, and Van Basten is dropping deep. But he's the only one causing problems. But even at this stage, even he's kind of drifted out of the game. England have another excellent chance when Gazza, in one of kind of the iconic moments of his World Cup, he Cruyff turns two Dutch players on the right and then clips right left-footed across the box, and Lineker can't just quite get there. Again, maybe feeling the ill effects of whatever caused his gastric catastrophe against Ireland.
Wasn't the crisps.
But then right at the end, literally, I think after about 92 minutes, again, this is in the days when we didn't know how much stoppage time was going to be played. That was only introduced in the kind of late 90s. England get a free kick on the left. The referee is clearly holding his arm up to indicate an indirect free kick. Stuart Pearce drives it at goal. Sorry, it's on the right-hand side of the goal, about 25 yards out, fairly oblique angle. Stuart Pearce drives it at goal, and it goes straight into the net, past a diving Van Breukelen, who really shouldn't have dived, because if he touched it, it was a valid goal. And England appear strangely bewildered that the goal hasn't been given, even though it's been clearly signalled as an indirect free kick. It's the last action of the game, and that disappointment lingers for a couple of hours until someone explains the rules of football to the English squad and fans and media. And I think ultimately, I should point out as well, Brian Robson picks up another knock in this game, which, added to his existing injuries, puts him in serious doubt for the rest of the tournament. But I think heartening performance from England, a lot more creativity, a lot more football than they played against Ireland. Gazza getting on the ball.
Just a note on the Brian Robson thing, because I've been watching back a fair bit of Saint and Greavesy around this time, which is a remarkable programme to watch back. But they absolutely jinxed Brian Robson the week before this game by kind of going, you're all good now, aren't you? Like, no more injury worries. It's fine. You'll be great. You'll be leading us to glory. That's the very next game.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up the change in system for England. There was a leadership group of the likes of Gary Lineker and Terry Butcher and Brian Robson, the more senior players, who did have the ear of Bobby Robson. But, you know, according to Lineker anyway, the switch to the sweeper, the three at the back, was Robson's idea, and he came to the team and kind of agreed it with them. So Paul Parker certainly wasn't expecting it. He didn't play in the first game. He's probably the best fullback in England at the time, but he wasn't getting into the national team. And Bobby came up to him the day before the game and told him, you know, you're playing tomorrow. And he's like, oh, great. And he's like, you're playing as a wing back. And he's like, what? I've never done that before in my life. So it does seem to have been something that was brought down from above, and maybe wasn't as driven by the grassroots as it's been made out since.
He does a great job as well, Paul Parker, actually, in that game. He's very, very effective. He's very, very busy. The Dutch don't seem to know how to be dealing with him, which, as you said, is very strange considering, I mean, Netherlands and their sort of egos around being tactically astute. It's a case of Paul Parker just running up the flank. That seems to catch them out quite a lot here as well. Just further on the injury thing as well, Turlock, Brian Robson's injured at this point. Haven't England already had an injury? Is it before this or during this point as well?
Yeah, they've already had David Seaman injure himself. Now, Seaman not expected to play, but they're given special dispensation, much as Argentina will be, to replace him with Dave Besant, who's obviously been making a name for himself at Wimbledon. So Besant comes in as third choice goalkeeper behind Chris Woods, and by all accounts, Besant had an absolute blast at the World Cup, just basically being around world-class players, being in the midst of this festival of football, but having absolutely no responsibility because he knows he's not going to play. So he made the most of it.
Well, mind you, I mean, we were just talking about Cameroon's backup goalkeeper in the earlier episode, coming along for the, please don't pick me, I just wanted to come along for the ride. So maybe Besson's going to be up to a bit of that as well. Let's very quickly check in then with the Irish camp before our big game tomorrow. We've had a look at these sides now. We've played England. We've seen Netherlands absolutely chuck it in. There's nothing to fear here, surely. We've got this in the bag now.
Yeah, that seems to be the general consensus, although it's fraying slightly as we learn a bit more about the Egyptians. And I suppose as we come to terms a little bit with the limitations of Ireland's first performance against England, Mahmoud El Ghohari, who's the Egyptian manager, he sums it up very succinctly in one of my favourite quotes of the World Cup. He's asked about the England-Ireland game, and he just says, we saw the England-Ireland game, but we didn't understand it. almost literally as though they were playing in a foreign language, or, you know, they were playing a different sport. But he is very complimentary about Jack Charlton. He says he's a brilliant manager. He says he's a great motivator and a great tactician. The Irish media, they have a slightly dodgy obsession, not only with ancient Egypt and puns based around ancient Egypt, but also with the fact that the Egyptian players are Muslims. They question the Egyptian team very closely on how their religion affects their preparations and their careers. The Egyptian spokesman gives very kind of thoughtful, considered answers to all of those questions, and then seemingly runs out of patience and just says, look, you know, we know that you may have seen fans drinking, or there may be stories of players drinking, but there are bad Muslims just as there are bad Catholics in Ireland, which is fairly withering if you meant it as passively aggressively as it comes across. In terms of the Ireland camp, by all accounts, Niall Quinn is absolutely flying in training and it is in contention for a place in the team. The Irish squad and setup are very worried about the heat. They're very worried about the fact that the stadium isn't closed and that there won't be much breeze fluttering around La Favorita, and that might affect the kind of high-tempo game that the Irish play. Other than that, Ronnie Whelan has come through a fitness test. I know every update seems to be basically, what did Ronnie Whelan have for breakfast today? But he was an obsession of the Irish media. Actually, yeah. I was playing football with his nephew around this time.
Glenn Whelan?
It wasn't Glenn Whelan. I think his name was Anto. He lived in somewhere in Slogrove in Ballymun anyway. But maybe he just claimed to be Ronnie Whelan's nephew, actually.
Probably.
That had never occurred to me in the past 30 years. But yeah, he was also vocally in favour of Whelan coming into the side. There's also been an unfortunate incident for an Irish fan from County Carlow who's getting assistance from the FAI. He went out on the lash after leaving £1,000 worth of traveller's checks in the socket of his bedside lamp in the hotel room. A friend of his who was sharing the room came back, turned on the lamp, and it all went up in smoke. So he's being helped out by the FAI. That's possibly certainly if you believe the urban legends, worse things happened in Korea, Japan years later. But yeah, he's not having a good World Cup.
The Ronnie Whelan stuff reminds me of like Beckham or Rooney when they did their metatarsal. It's just like, my God, every week it's a new Ronnie Whelan story, you know?
Exactly. But I mean, you have to remember he was a multiple European Cup winning player and he'd been kind of indispensable to the Irish team up until maybe a year earlier when he started, you know, drifting in and out with it with various injuries. But as I think I said in the previous episode, I think Charlton would take Townsend over Whelan pretty much any day just for his, you know, dynamism, for his ability to mix it and for his aggression.
His left foot.
Yeah, exactly. His Lee Brady-esque masterpiece of a left foot, as Chris Hughton claimed. The indications are kind of firming up that we're going to see an unchanged team against Egypt, probably unchanged tactics. And just how wise that is, we'll find out in 24 hours.
Great. Well, we look forward to that. We've also got all the action in Group E to look forward to tomorrow. Korea, Spain and Belgium, Uruguay.
Back over this side, calls for it. Aiken goes to the middle. Roy Aiken! Good save! Still Aiken! And the referee says penalty! And he's gone!